Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM on the campus. On March the 8th, 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case of McCollum v. Board of Education. Vashti McCollum, the mother of a student in the Champaign, Illinois public schools, challenged the use of religious teachers who were allowed to substitute their religious instruction for the secular teaching that was provided under the compulsory education law for a few minutes each day. McCollum claimed this violated the First and 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. The result, ultimately, was a landmark decision in the use of tax-supported schools for religious instruction. The student who was the focal point of this case, James McCollum, will speak at MTSU's Honors Building on Monday, March the 17th, from 1 to 2 p.m. His address is free and open to the public and commemorates the 60th anniversary of the decision, McCollum v. Board of Education. Dr. McCollum is speaking with us from his office at Southern Arkansas University in Magnolia, Arkansas, via telephone. Dr. McCollum, welcome and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This was an overrule of a circuit court decision. Then it went up to the State Supreme Court of Illinois. They sided with the circuit court, which ruled in favor of the schools. And then finally it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then by an 8-1 decision, they ruled in your mother's favor. How old were you at the time all this legal action was taking place, and did you understand what was going on?
Well, I was 9 years old when I ran into, actually 8 years old when I ran into the program, because that was when I was in fourth grade. The suit was filed when I was 11. And yes, I was fully aware of all the legal ramifications.
Did you what sort of an understanding did you have of the constitutional issues at age 11? I'm sure you were a very bright child, but did you really get everything that was going on?
Well, I of course focused in on the Establishment of Religion clause of the First Amendment, and of course it says that you cannot have an established religion. But the I was not aware of all the constitutional issues. I didn't realize that the First Amendment does not apply to the states. Barron versus Baltimore, an 1833 case. The 14th Amendment is due process clause is what the courts use to apply the First Amendment to the states.
This religious instruction came about through a relationship between the public schools and this ecumenical group called the Champaign Council on Religious Education. When you went into this instruction, what was it like? What would they say to the students?
Well, initially, the teacher would recruit everybody into the class, the public school teacher, and put quite a bit of pressure on everybody to be involved. I suppose she wanted an hour off. But in any case, in those days, teachers got stars on their door for various things. If everybody bought war stamps for a given month or a given week, they got a star on the door. If there was perfect attendance, they got a star on the door. And he actually got a star on the door for having complete enrollment in this religious studies class. We were handed a little card, and we were supposed to get our parents' signature on that card and bring a quarter, and that would enroll us in the class.
And when you got into the class, what would they actually say to you about God or religion or faith?
Well, of course, initially I didn't take the class. My mother would not allow it. But I agitated, and the teacher was putting pressure on both me and my parents. Plus, there was a certain amount of peer pressure. So, and I was curious of what it was all about. And eventually I did get into the class. Actually, they were Sunday school lessons, essentially, that to me, anyhow, seemed like they were aimed at kindergarten students rather than people who were in the fourth grade. I just did not feel that they were on the sophistication level of fourth grader.
What can you tell me about the atmosphere in the area that allowed for this Champaign Council on Religious Education to form and gain such an inroad into public education? This is the sort of thing that people frequently associate with the Bible Belt, but this occurred in Illinois. Was Champaign a particularly conservative or religious community?
It definitely was part of the Bible Belt at the time. It's not now. My brother ended up in recent years as the longest sitting mayor ever of Champaign, Illinois, second known Democrat to hold a job, and the first known atheist. So times have changed.
I should say. Was your brother older or younger than you?
I was the oldest of the three sons.
And did he encounter this religious instruction or attempt at religious instruction as well?
I don't think so. I think by the time that this thing went through the courts pretty quickly, he might have run into it a little bit in fourth grade, but I don't think he was involved too much in it.
Did the supporters of this religious instruction argue that this was a comparative religion course as opposed to indoctrination, or was there no pretense about what their motives were?
There was no pretense. They were strictly sectarian. They had the version that I ran into was a sort of a pan-Protestant version, and they had a Catholic version. The small Jewish community initially was involved, but they pulled out pretty quickly because they realized it was not in their best interests.
What did you grow up learning in your own home about God and faith and atheism, and what was your parental guidance on that, all of those issues?
Well, it just was not an issue in our family. We didn't think about it one way or the other until we ran into the situation in fourth grade. At that point, of course, I became quite interested in comparative religion personally, and was involved in the Unitarian Church in Champaign-Urbana, where they actually, one of the Sunday school classes was actually a comparative religions class, and I've been interested in comparative religions pretty much ever since.
Which is a far cry from what they were trying to accomplish with this particular course of instruction.
Exactly.
Was your mother an atheist, or was she an agnostic? How would you describe her in that way?
Well, she described herself as an agnostic. As far as she was concerned, the existence of a supreme being was not an issue one way or another. My father, on the other hand, was raised down here in Arkansas. In fact, we live on the old family home place. And he was one of 11 children. By the time he left Magnolia to go to college at Oklahoma A&M, he had already become a confirmed atheist by virtue of the fact that he'd had all the religion that he could handle up to that point.
What particular denomination was he raised in?
Well, you had to understand the times. They had a lot of these small rural churches, and you went to whatever church had the circuit riding preacher for that particular Sunday. His father was a Cumberland Presbyterian, and his mother was a Baptist. But they would go to the Cumberland Church one Sunday, and then to the Hepsiby Baptist Church another Sunday, and then a third Sunday they'd go to one of the rural Methodist churches and so forth. And as I say, whatever church had the circuit riding preacher, that's where they went, and that's pretty much what everybody down there did at the time.
When your mother filed suit and this became an issue for the courts, what, if any, were the ramifications on you and your family? Did you get negative feedback? Were you harassed? Did people leave you alone? Did they pat you on the back and say good for you? What was the reaction?
Well, definitely not the latter. when I was in fifth grade, the suit hadn't been filed yet, but there I ran into some very serious consequences. The teacher put me out in the hall at a desk during the religious studies, religious education classes, and that desk usually was used for kids that were disruptive. And when my mother heard about that, she raised a cane, and I was then transferred into the music room, which was also a penitent area, but at least I wasn't exposed to the ridicule. Sixth grade wasn't too bad, but by the time I got to junior high school, and the case was going at that point, things were to the point where I really couldn't concentrate on my studies, so my parents sent me out to Rochester, New York, to live with my grandparents, where I went to a private school for a year and a half.
And what was that like for you?
Well, that was a good experience. The school has a very large Jewish population. They're pretty much in favor of the case. So it really things returned to normal, essentially, as far as I was concerned. It was a nice experience.
How did this affect your relationship with your mother? Did she take you aside and say, honey, I'm doing this because I love you, and you've got to understand that?
No, none of that. I was with her every step of the way. I never had any doubts. My brothers never had any doubts. We were 100% behind it, and she didn't have to explain a thing.
And the irony of all of this is that you are married to a Unitarian minister.
Yes, I am.
And Betty is going to be delivering a sermon later on today. I say today because this is being aired on the 16th. We obviously recorded it in advance, entitled When Dreams Collide. How did you and Betty meet?
Well, I knew her back early on when I was in Rochester, New York. I practiced law there for 34 years. She was a member of the same church that my then wife and I were members of. Eventually, I became divorced from my first wife, but Betty had gone on to Massachusetts and had become involved in religious education there at a church in Framingham. Some 17 years after my first divorce, Betty and I hooked up again and got married.
Did your mother ever have a chance to meet Betty?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, Betty's mother moved down here with Betty and me, and the two women were very close, Betty's mother and my mother.
What do you make, taking this conversation rather abruptly from a micro to a macro paradigm, what do you make, Dr. McCollum, of the rise of evangelical and fundamentalist religion in U.S. politics in recent decades?
Well, for the first time in history, we have had a religious party, and I think that's unfortunate. I get the feeling that the Republicans may be kind of shrugging that off now, but certainly the success of Mike Huckabee in the recent Republican primary indicates that they're still a major force in this country.
There is
the movement towards a theocracy has been very unsettling.
You're referring to those groups like the Arm, the Sword, and the Covenant of the Lord, and groups like that who actually advocate that this is a Christian nation.
Well, Mike Huckabee even said that the God's word cannot be modified, but the Constitution can, and the Constitution should be brought in line with God's word. And I think that is a sentiment that many of some of these fundamentalists and the religious right share.
And certain social conservatives always argue that separation of church and state is a concept not found in the Constitution when they argue the point about religious freedom or argue for against a wall of separation of church and state that Thomas Jefferson argued for in a letter to a Baptist church. But do you think that the Establishment Clause is sufficient, or should the actual word separation of church and state be codified in the Constitution to strengthen this wall?
Well, first of all, you can't equate social conservatives with the religious right. They're two different groups. Now, some may belong to both groups, but you can't equate them. I don't know that all the religious right would ascribe to the idea that the separation of church and state is not specifically set forth in the Constitution. But the Supreme Court has ruled repeatedly that that concept is what the Establishment of Religion Clause of the Constitution means. I think the Constitution has served very well over the 200-plus years that it's been in effect. It's the oldest written Constitution in the world, believe it or not.
Some people have posited that the Republican Party's co-option or relationship with, if you will, the religious right is more of a diversion from economic issues that that they would like to put forth. In other words, keeping people roiled up about abortion, gay marriage, and whatnot distracts people from economic issues so that they can advance that particular agenda. And then at the end of the day, not even the religious right gets everything out of the Republican politicians they support that they thought they would. What do you think about that thesis?
Well, I've never heard that articulated before, but it makes a certain amount of sense.
It's kind of difficult to fathom. The Supreme Court over time, and of course those are political appointees, with the advice and consent of the Senate. The composition of the court at the time of your case seems to have been pivotal. Hugo Black, who wrote the lead opinion, Felix Frankfurter, Robert Jackson, who prosecuted at the Nuremberg trial, these are not legal or intellectual lightweights. Do you consider yourself lucky in that regard?
Absolutely, especially when you view the current court.
What's your view of the current court?
Well, I think not very high. I think the current court has been pretty much manipulated by the Republican Party, the conservatives, and the religious right. And unfortunately, it is not a friendly court to separation of church and state issues.
Can you cite a few specific examples of what you're talking about?
Well, there's been some recent cases, and I can't really enumerate them off the back of my hand, that seem to indicate that the court is not particularly anxious to follow the Warren Court's view on separation of church and state. The idea of the faith-based initiatives that President Bush has been pushing. The Supreme Court held that taxpayers cannot contest that. There are other cases that, in the same vein, that indicate that the court is turning away from the separation of church and state to some extent. How seriously it is, it'll depend on such things as Michael Nudo's case going up to the Supreme Court eventually, I imagine, regarding the Pledge of Allegiance inclusion of the clause under God, one nation under God. When Francis Bellamy wrote that, and by the way, he was a Baptist minister, he specifically did not put any references to religion or God in the Pledge of Allegiance.
This is a case out of San Francisco, right?
Yes. That was added during Eisenhower's administration in 1954, and I think it was added in the same vein as putting a clove of garlic over your kitchen window to keep the devil out, in this case, to keep the communists out.
In Justice Reed's dissent from the McCollum v. Board of Education opinion, and his was the only dissenting opinion in this 8-1 ruling. I'll read a section of it. This court cannot be too cautious in upsetting practices embedded in our society by many years of experience. A state is entitled to have great leeway in its legislation when dealing with the important social problems of its population. A definite violation of legislative limits must be established. The Constitution should not be stretched to forbid national customs and the way courts act to reach arrangements to avoid federal taxation. Devotion to the great principle of religious liberty should not lead us into a rigid interpretation of the constitutional guarantee that conflicts with accepted habits of our people. He seems to be saying that certain customs and practices at the local level should trump constitutional law. Am I reading that wrong?
No, you're not. I think he was unwilling to include the Establishment of Religion Clause within the purview of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Virtually all except two of the rights in the Bill of Rights have been incorporated in court decisions over the years within the purview of the Due Process Clause. This was the second case that involved anything like that. The first one had to do with freedom of religion, and he apparently didn't want to go that route.
It just struck me as a bizarre thing for any jurist to say, let alone someone on the Supreme Court. It seemed antithetical to the whole purpose of the institution to which he belonged. Justice Hugo Black wrote the lead opinion, and I'll quote from it as well, to hold that a state cannot consistently, with the First and 14th Amendments, utilize its public school system to aid any or all religious faiths or sects in the dissemination of their doctrines and ideals, does not, as counsel urge, manifest a governmental hostility to religion or religious teachings. A manifestation of such hostility would be at war with our national tradition as embodied in the First Amendment's guarantee of the free exercise of religion. For the First Amendment rests upon the premise that both religion and government can best work to achieve their lofty aims if each is left free from the other within its respective sphere. Or, as we said in the Everson case, the First Amendment had erected a wall between church and state which must be kept high and impregnable. And he seems to be going out of his way to try to reassure people, even though this is an 8-1 ruling, that this ruling establishing or reaffirming separation of church and state is not an attack on religion.
Yes, and there was an awful lot of controversy over that case at the time. It made national headlines, and I think he was kind of reacting on that. The Everson case was a 5-4 decision, and he wrote the opinion in that, and that had to do with providing school bus transportation for parochial school students in New Jersey. And the dicta in that case was the basis for the decision in the McCollum case. And he wanted to make it clear that there's a difference between strict separation of church and state, the Establishment of Religion Clause, and freedom of religion.
How do you feel about the use of taxpayer-funded school buildings as meeting places for non-mandatory student activities like, say, the local chapter of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes wants to meet in a public school building after hours? That's a very different situation from the one that your mother encountered.
Absolutely. I have no problem with that. The only problem that I would have is if they have a church service or something like that there, and the people that are using it for church service are not paying the same amount as anybody else that would use those buildings. If the buildings are available for free for anybody to have meetings and so forth, then I don't have a problem with religious groups using it.
When the ruling came down in 1948 from the U.S. Supreme Court, What was the reaction in Champaign? How did the townspeople and the city fathers take to it?
I don't know. I wasn't there. I was in Rochester, New York at the time.
Didn't your parents tell you anything about it?
Well, if they did, I don't remember. I don't think they did, but again, that was a long time ago.
Did it influence the way that the approach that you take to dealing with children and grandchildren, or even your college students, insofar as the whole issue of religion and separation of church and state is concerned?
Well, I don't know quite how to answer that. Obviously, I've been very active in separation of church and state issues ever since. I'm an active member of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and I belong to three other organizations that are involved in this issue. I'm the founder of the Arkansas chapter of Americans United for Separation of Church and State and remain one of their officers. So I suppose that's, to that extent, I've certainly been influenced by the case.
Does it get any easier to be an advocate in the way that you are with the passage of time, or do you face new and tougher challenges? Is it all retrograde at this point, or is there progress being made?
Well, I haven't experienced any real challenges ever since the end of the case. When I came back to Champaign at the end of my eighth grade year, I entered University High School, which is a school run by the University of Illinois, and very liberal atmosphere there. Didn't run into any problems there. Certainly didn't run into any problems in college or law school either. And I haven't run into any real problems since then, even down here.
So Arkansans are pretty well accepting of you and your point of view.
Well, they asked me to join Rotary, and five months after I joined Rotary, I gave a talk on separation of church and state. I must admit I rankled a few folks there, but they've also asked me to be president in a year, so I must not have rankled too many folks.
As we go forward as a country in this presidential election year, how do you think that the American people, the American voters, should hold the candidates' feet to the fire on church and state issues?
Well, I think they definitely should hold their feet to the fire. As a matter of fact, Americans United puts out, and other groups too, questionnaires that are specifically aimed at candidates and encourages their members to ask these candidates these various questions and elicit their response. We did that quite a bit in Rochester. Haven't done that too much down here. I've been kind of busy down here myself, and I'm 2.5 hours out of Little Rock, so I don't get a chance to do much up there. But we used to do quite a bit of that in Rochester, New York.
In this presidential election year, though, does it not seem a bit curious to you that all three of the candidates seem to be compelled to or motivated to do a certain amount of pandering to religious interests?
It tends to bother me, but on the other hand, one of the problems that Barack Obama is running into is a whisper campaign claiming that he's a Muslim. I've run into that down here even with some of the students here at the university. And so he's had to bend over backwards to say he's a member of the United Church of Christ and has been right along. They all seem to be compelled to say God bless America and God bless the audience. And this is something that really has only occurred in recent years. The candidates didn't used to do that back in the 50s and 60s.
Not even during the Cold War, when we were supposedly fighting the godless communists.
No, not even during the Cold War.
What do you think of a political candidate who says that his faith or her faith informs the way he or she governs? That's not exactly, you know, that personal touch is not a direct violation of the Establishment Clause, but it is a declaration on the part of an individual that does give some voters pause when they hear it.
It doesn't bother me too much. I have, obviously, my faith determines how I interact with people and the jobs that I have. It doesn't mean that I impose my faith on anybody, and I would take somebody at their word that they wouldn't impose their faith on somebody. Now, George Bush, on the other hand, does have a tendency to do this. So he's gone across the line as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Dr. McCollum, you and your family are very courageous, and your place in history is well assured, and I think people will be very interested to hear you speak at the Honors Building on March 17th from 1 to 2 p.m., commemorating the 60th anniversary of McCollum v. Board of Education. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at this same time next Sunday. You can catch us at mtsunews.com. We're also available on iTunes.